This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 256 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'd like to introduce two co-hosts. First, we have Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hey, Rob.
Hey, hi, everybody, and thanks for joining us tonight. I'm not even going to talk about the weather. Let's just say that things are relatively dandy here in Chicago.
You've been a busy little guy with the media, with the mainstream press in the last few days, haven't you?
Yeah, they contacted me on Saturday right after the Asiana accident, and I've been trying to help the media guys at, I don't know, probably 8 or 10 different outlets around the country kind of turn aviation chat into text or stories that normal people can understand.
Yeah.
So we've been a little busy.
So I caught you on Fox News while I was doing the laundry. That was pretty exciting.
So which was more exciting, doing the laundry or watching me on Fox News?
Yeah, it was kind of a toss-up, but in the end, I think I went with you, Rob.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
All right. Also co-hosting is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. I, too, caught Rob over the weekend multiple times, and I spent the day, to make it short and sweet, telling all my co-workers what happened over the weekend. It's kind of amazing when you suddenly become the office expert on a topic, and you get surrounded at your cube the moment you walk in the door. It's been a long day.
All right, well, let's introduce our guests. We have two guests from Saker Aircraft. First, Sean Gillette. He's the chief executive officer. Now, Sean has been interested in aviation since he was a youngster, soloing at age 16 and earning his private pilot license at 17 and his instructor ratings at 18. He earned a private and commercial helicopter ratings. And at age 21, Sean graduated from pilot training class with the U.S. Air Force, where he flew the C-21. Which is, I guess, Sean, that's the Lear 35 or Lear 35A, is that correct?
That's yeah, that's correct. It's a military version, just slightly modified. But thank you for having us.
Well, it's a pleasure. After leaving the Air Force, you went on to form Saker Aircraft. And it's a real pleasure to have you here on the podcast. Now, our other guest from the same company is John Narroway. John, you're with the you're the marketing function in this little enterprise, and that's kind of all I know about your background. Have you got an aviation history to you as well?
Actually, not quite. My background is dealing with quite a few luxury brands and startups, and I've actually got a bit more of a motor background, an auto background, having done some work with General Motors in Canada, Bridgestone Tires, working on their Formula One programs and things like that. So it's been an interesting career for me. I love aviation, though, so it's a dream come true to be working on the project.
It's fantastic. Now, Sean, this company, you're on a mission to produce a very interesting jet, which we're going to talk about soon. But for now, can you give our listeners the 30-second version of what this jet is all about?
Yeah, absolutely. Our whole goal is, you can read our tagline, it's basically providing general aviation with military style and performance and giving the user an experience that has never been given before. It's about being able to travel extremely fast and at the same time have the ability to afford it while also experiencing some luxury amenities along the way.
Very cool. Now, this is a very exciting project, at least for me, and I'm sure the other two guys as well. And we look forward to talking about that in some detail. First, though, we're going to talk about some of the recent aviation news from the past week. And David, the 777, of course, has been in the news lately with the Asiana 214 accident. We're going to talk about that some. But David, you're going to give us a little bit of history first about the 777. Is that right?
Yep. I think it's fair and appropriate to talk about an airplane that is surprisingly safe. For an airliner, it's got quite the reputation.
Okay, that's great. We're gonna start with that in just a second. But we also have Stephen Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast with their Australia desk report. They're going to talk about Tiger Airways rebranding the first Royal Australian Navy MH-60R Romeo that's flying around Connecticut these days. Virgin Australia has, they've introduced a frequent flyer program, something about for pets. Can't wait to hear what that's all about. And they've got a couple other items as well. And then also, Peter Johnson returns with a short Across the Pond segment. He's going to tell us about stumbling across an old friend in a vineyard. And he's going to give us a quick review of a great book he's reading about a NASA test pilot. And we'll close out with some of the listener mail we received in the past week. That's always exciting. All right, let's get started with the news. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
All right. As we mentioned, the Asiana 214 story has been probably the major news of the recent week. And we're going to invert the order a little bit here. And David is going to start us off talking about the Boeing 777. And then we'll talk about some aspects of the Asiana accident. So, David, take it away.
Thanks, Max. The Airplane Geeks Airplane of the Week, the Boeing 777. I guess it's fair to say that I wasn't sure if I should do this. I'm following the majority lead on what people have said on Facebook and Twitter. As you know, I don't do accidents. Some you have to do in history, but I could talk about a significant accident in history every week if I wanted to. I choose not to, and why I think you should know. Personally, I've witnessed two in my life. One was an ejection of a child on July 4th, 1980 from an S3 Viking. I was standing under the Viking when it happened. The second one was the crash of an F-14 Tomcat from VF-101, also at Willow Grove, almost 20 years later on June 18th, 2000. So I've witnessed them, so therefore in the history segments I try to avoid the accident portion of the aviation history. We are recording this on Monday, July 8th, 2013, the Monday after Asiana's 214's crash at San Francisco International Airport. We currently have two people who've lost their lives in the incident. Those are the first two fatalities due to a crash of a 777. One other person has died due to a refueling incident on the ground at Denver International Airport on September 5th, 2001. What is a 777 or a 777? Originally, it was a trijet. Boeing began working on the 777 with the 75 and the 76. The 757 was designed to replace the 727. The 767 was designed to replace the 707s and early 747s. The 777 was going to go after the trijet market of the Lockheed L-1011 and Douglas DC-3. But at the time, it was decided that Boeing should focus on the 75 and the 76, and they put aside the 777. The DC-10s and L-1011s were aging out of the fleets in the late 80s and needed replacements. McDonnell Douglas came up with the MD-11, and Airbus entered into the competition with the A330 and A340. Boeing joined in with the Boeing 767-X. Multiple versions were proposed, a longer fuselage than the 767-300, a cockpit retained but with a wider cross-section. Airlines weren't happy with the bigger 767. They clearly wanted a new airframe. Boeing then took the novel approach and requested input on the aircraft from the airlines themselves. The Working Together Group, as Boeing coined it, consisted of American, United, and Delta as the U.S. carriers, and ANA, BA, Cathay Pacific, JAL, and Qantas for overseas input. What came out was a two-engine aircraft with a cabin almost as wide as the 747 that could carry 325 passengers. United would become the launch customer on October 14, 1990, ordering 34 airframes with Pratt & Whitney PW4084 engines. With these engines, the 777 became the first aircraft to enter service with an ETOPS rating of 180 minutes. That was quickly extended to 207 minutes 6 months later. The Pratt & Whitney 4084 engines were only one-third of the engine choices originally. The airframe could also come with GE 9077Bs and Rolls-Royce Trent 877s. The GEs were introduced by British Airways and the Trents by Thailand. Nine aircraft were tested using the three engines. All were flown on one engine to make the 180 ETOPS requirement. On April 19, 1995, the aircraft was given simultaneous airworthy certificates from the FAA and the European Joint Aviation Authorities. Of note, the rollout of the 777 occurred on April 9, 1994. Its first flight occurred only 64 days later on July 12, 1994. Compare that to the 99 days for the A380 and the 891 days for the 787. Ah, the good old days of aircraft production. United had the first revenue flight on June 7, 1995. The flight was from Heathrow to Dulles using November 777 UA. Boeing clearly had a winner on its hands. The next major variant after the 772 was the 777-200ER. ER stood for extended range. Originally called the 200 IGW, IGW being increased gross weight, thankfully Boeing didn't keep that moniker, the ER features a higher gross weight to accommodate additional fuel. The ER was a record breaker. A 200ER called Super Ranger flew from Boeing Field in Seattle nonstop to Kuala Lumpur, 10,823 miles in 21 hours and 23 minutes. The 200ER also holds the record for the longest ETOPS diversion. United Flight 842 on March 17, 2003 flew for 177 minutes on one engine, saving 255 passengers on a flight from Sydney to LAX. The next variant was designed to replace the Boeing 747-100s and 200s. The 777-300 has a 33.3-foot stretch over the 200 version, making the overall length 242 feet 4 inches. The 300 in its high-capacity version can carry 550 people. This version has been adopted by the Japanese airlines. Lord knows that I couldn't fit in that seat pitch. The additional length created some additional challenge. One required the addition of a tail skid to avoid rotation strikes. Also, the aircraft is equipped with ground viewing cameras for taxiing. The first 300 would be delivered to Cathay Pacific on May 21, 1998. During this time, Boeing realized it needed new engines in the 100,000-pound thrust range. General Electric created the GE90-115Bs. Rolls-Royce proposed the Trent 8104 engine. The GE was selected, and part of the contract would be going forward only the GE90 would be offered. The 200 was again strengthened in 2004. The 200LR, or as Boeing called the Worldliner, would connect almost any two airports in the world. The LR features 12.8 feet wingtip extensions and three additional fuel tanks in the cargo hold. On November 10, 2005, an LR flew from Hong Kong to Heathrow. The flight was 11,664 nautical miles in 22 hours and 42 minutes, breaking the record held by another Boeing product, the B-52. On April 29, 2004, Air France took delivery of the first of the most successful versions. The 777-300ER, the ER had the extended wingtips of the 200LR and the GE90-115s, with 115,300 pounds of thrust. These, as well as reinforced landing gear, more fuel tanks, and higher gross weight, make the 300ER able to fly 34% farther than the 300 with the same payload. The 300ER has been sold to 24 different customers with a current backlog of 284 aircraft. The last major variant would be the 777F. Based on the 200LR again, the freighter can carry 226,000 pounds of payload, 4,900 nautical miles. Again, Air France was the first customer taking delivery of its first aircraft on April 19, 2009. Boeing is also looking to converting existing ER and LR frames into freighters. Boeing introduced the future of 777s at Paris in 2013. The 777-8X and the 777-9X will carry 350 and 400 passengers, respectively. The 777X will feature 10 abreast seating. Learning from the 7-8, it will have a larger composite wing, which will be able to fold for carrier operations. Okay, I jest.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Wing folds have been an option for many of the variants of the 777. However, they haven't been taken. The flight deck will also share commonality with the 787 also. Since 1993, some 20 years, the 777 has been plying the skies over the biggest oceans. What truly makes this impressive was up until Saturday, there were only 8 incidents and 2 incidents that required the airframes to be written off. The most serious issue involved the Trent 895 engines. On January 17, 2008, British Airways Flight 38 from Beijing to London landed approximately 1,000 feet short of Heathrow's 27 left. The accident which caused the ER to be written off had no fatalities and only 47 injured. Initial indications from the interviews and flight recorder analysis showed that the flight and approach to have progressed normally until the aircraft was established on late finals for runway 27 left. At approximately 600 feet and 2 miles from touchdown, the autothrottle demanded an increase in thrust from the two engines, but the engines did not respond. Following further demands for increased thrust from the autothrottle and subsequently the flight crew moving the throttle levers, the engine similarly failed to respond. The aircraft speed reduced and the aircraft descended onto the grass short of the paved runway surface. Eventually, it was discovered that ice crystals had clogged the FOHE, or fuel oil heat exchangers. The FOHE warms the oil from the tanks and then also uses that oil to cool the oil in the engine. Each engine has one. The FOHE had a design flaw on the Trent that while the oil itself didn't freeze, water in the oil did, clogging the engines and causing the loss of power. While not an accident per se, 2 Delta Airlines flights also had temporary losses of power in February and November of 2008. This caused a revision of the Trent engine. The second write-off was on July 29, 2001, and Egypt Air 200ER was parked at the gate at Cairo International. The aircraft was successfully evacuated because of a cockpit fire. The cause of the fire was an electrical fault with the oxygen supply system. The 777 is Boeing's most profitable aircraft, with over 1,400 in service and a back order close to 350. The 777 is the unsung hero of the long-range route. With the Dash 8X and 9X, 777s should be flying for the globe for years to come. An aircraft with a legacy and capability that most airline manufacturers should aspire towards. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Very good, David. That's a great summary. I mean, the 777 is a very, I think, highly regarded aircraft. Rob, maybe you could give us just sort of a really brief summary of the Asiana 214 accident before we kind of get into a conversation about that.
Well, sure. What we know at this point is that Asiana 214 was cleared to land on 28 left, which is about a 11,500-foot runway at San Francisco International Airport. That was on Saturday morning. As the aircraft approached, the sources I've looked at, some from FlightAware.com, which we all use to kind of track airplanes all over the world, showed that the aircraft was a little high, and so it started coming down. We're assuming, we don't know, we're assuming because the crew pulled the power back. And, of course, at one point at roughly, I'm doing this off the top of my head, I think it was at about 2.5 miles on final or 3 miles on final, they were still coming down at 1,400 and something feet a minute with the power back at idle. And all we know is that they got extremely low, they got extremely slow, and at short final, the aircraft was slowed, from what Deb Herzman at the NTSB said today, down to 100 knots, which is about 35 knots below the speed it should have been at. And it was also just in the midst of trying to go around when it struck the jetty, which is essentially a little dike there right at the approach end of the 28 runways at San Francisco, because, of course, that airport is surrounded pretty much by water. The airplane hit the dike, sheared the gear off. The airplane slammed down on the runway hard enough that the horizontal stable. In fact, the entire tail section separated from the airplane. It skidded around down the runway and ended up in the grass on the left-hand side about, maybe 2,000 feet or so from the approach end. And it caught fire. But the miraculous part is that except for two young ladies that who did lose their lives in the accident, more than 300 people escaped, some with various injuries. All those people got out alive. And that is a miraculous end to that.
Well, Rob, there's an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal that was authored by a couple of folks, including our friend John Ostrower, titled "Why the San Francisco Plane Crash Wasn't More Deadly." And I thought they made some really interesting observations. I mean, one of the things they talked about were issues surrounding the people involved, the flight attendants, the passengers, and even the arriving first responders. Really, it sounds like they acted in fantastic ways that supported each other, helped each other, carried each other, freed each other from some who were trapped in the plane. And that had, I think, a significant effect on the outcome of that. That was a great thing.
Well, I think we cannot say enough about the flight attendants. We really have to sing their accolades. I mean, there were a dozen or so of them on the airplane. And for people that may not understand why we're singing their accolades quite so much, think of a firehouse and everybody's asleep. And when that bell goes off, those firefighters jump into action. They get the clothes on, they slide down the pole or whatever it is. I don't know if they still do that, but and they make it to the trucks that are on their way, and the adrenaline is pumping. And so these flight attendants basically had the same kind of a situation. They had no notice prior to the airplane slamming into the ground and sliding that there was anything unusual going on. And they jumped into action and got all those people out. Again, that's the really important end.
And I was seeing tonight on NBC News, they were talking about the first responders running up the ramps to get the additional people out. And some of the flight attendants refused to leave the aircraft until everybody else was off. That's just plain awesome. And for all of you people who ignore those people up in the front of the cabin at the beginning of the flight, telling you where your exits are and how to get out of the airplane, here's the living example on why you need to pay attention.
Yeah, for sure.
Do so at your own peril. I just want to mention one thing that I think is really important. These guys got so low out there on final that people in the back were reporting things. It's not enough for me to mention the exact details, but the point is that they were so low that if they had been even maybe 15 feet lower, they might have just about been touching the water. But if they'd been 15 feet lower, the nose of that airplane would have gone through that jetty, not the landing gear in the belly of the airplane. And we'd be talking about a much, much different kind of an accident story.
Yeah, for sure. Another thing that they point out in this Wall Street Journal article is changes that have been made over the years to the aircraft itself. And they noted that the seats on jetliners, they have to be able to survive collisions at 16G. And Boeing says that they've been delivering all of their jets with 16G rated seats since 2009. And this, of course, is to address the impact issue and seats breaking loose and, pancaking into each other and that sort of thing. So that was one of the things that was credited with sort of the outcome of this.
Though my only real one pet peeve and just blew my mind was some of the pictures you saw of the people mulling around the airframe after they got off and they were still carrying their rollerboards. Folks, if you're ever in that incident, it's not worth it. Just leave it on the damn airplane.
Yeah.
Just taking a few seconds to retrieve something that is very dear to you could result in the loss of your life or someone else's. Leave everything and get out.
And one other thing I think we should mention, I didn't hear anything about whether there were any infants on anybody's lap. during this flight, I'm hoping that there weren't. Of course, if there were, they obviously lived through it. But that's a perfect example of why you do not want to be holding a 2-year-old on your lap, because that kind of a slam dunk maneuver where the airplane stops so quickly with enough G forces to tear the tail off, you'll never be able to hold on to a baby. And that could have been even worse, but luckily, I guess that didn't happen.
So just to divert us a little bit and to bring Sean and John in, what are the requirements with regards to general aviation aircraft? When you're designing a GA aircraft or a jet, as in the case of you two guys, what are there requirements that have to be met that would affect issues like survivability?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have to understand, I'm not an engineer. I'm more business focused. I'll leave that to the smarter guys. But there is a lot of testing done with regards to the seat and the attachment points to the aircraft with the seat that have to go through some rigorous testing in order to ensure the safety of the occupants if something like that does occur. And the 16G number kind of does ring a bell for me, just from items that I've reviewed, and it's pretty intensive.
I think we've seen, especially with some of the newer jet, with the 787 and the A350, how they've stressed the wing to the point of breaking. Is there destructive testing in general aviation aircraft development?
Yeah, absolutely. Just like the videos you see of the Boeing aircraft going through the wing bending to fracture and structural failure, we do the exact same thing. We also do drop tests for the landing gear from 15 or 20 feet and ensure that everything stays intact. It's a very similar process, just a little less is required just due to the fact that we're not carrying a mass amount of passengers.
Sure. All right. Well, Rob, anything else on the on this accident? I guess that it's always difficult to speculate in advance of the facts and the investigation. And actually, I've seen quite a few comments on Twitter about that and about criticisms of folks in the press who are speculating and imagining without having the benefit of the facts or the investigation. But is there anything else about this incident, that this accident, that you think we ought to bring up right now?
Well, having been the recipient of a little bit of that action this weekend, I know that I certainly appreciate my friend David Vanderhoof's efforts on Twitter to defend me for, truth, justice, and the American way. But seriously, there is the Airline Pilots Association just sent out a news release about an hour ago, and they took the NTSB to task on this one because they believe the NTSB was not correct in releasing as much of the primary data from the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder so early on in the investigation. And so they were, in their own way, really upset. But again, that's something I think they're going to have to work out with the NTSB.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. All right, thanks. Let's move on to our next item. This comes from Wired.com. Oh, this is by Jason Parr, who's been on the show several times. The turbine-powered Chevy Volt of airliners looks fantastic. Well, this is something called the E-Thrust project. It's part of the EADS Innovation Works program, which is a partnership they have with Rolls-Royce. And these two companies are looking for ways that they can meet, according to this article, the European Commission's future vision of air travel, and that includes big reductions in emissions and noise. So basically this idea is a hybrid. The idea of the E-thrust is that you use several electrically driven fans to provide the thrust, but the power supply comes from a gas turbine engine that's used during cruising when it needs just enough electricity to stay in the air, the article says. And when it needs more power, like during takeoff and the climb, that it, a battery system provides an additional source of power for these fans. So this this concept has six electric fans that are in the wing roots, which reduces the drag of the aircraft. And as I mentioned, one turbine engine in the tail that generates the powers the power for the fans and the and also charges the batteries. And you know, this is it's a concept. I don't know if we'll ever ever see this in production, but it's kind of intriguing. I think it's great that people are thinking this far, probably decades ahead, and considering possibilities. What do you guys think? Are you guys sort of excited by this, or do you think it's just another concept that may never pan out?
I actually don't even care whether it pans out or not, to be honest. I'm just excited every time I see someone open up a or initiate a business project that wants to challenge the envelope, essentially, whether it's electric power or biofuels or who knows what. I think it's just really great that people are still in there in the good fight, trying to come up with better airplanes or better propulsion systems or better wings or whatever. And so I hope that alone doesn't stop. And but then of course I think this is kind of cool.
Yeah, I think it is, and it I agree with you. And it really kind of takes what we have and kind of takes it apart in some ways and then reassembles it. So, you know, most people know that most of the power from modern high bypass ratio turbofans comes from the fan, with the jet in the core actually producing very little of the total thrust. It's mostly generating the or turning the fan up front that's giving you the thrust. At the same time, we know that just pure electric aircraft, I mean, that's kind of difficult, especially if you're talking about airliner-sized aircraft. I mean, the weight of the batteries is sort of, you know, prohibitive. So this takes the idea and says, all right, so if the fans are generating the thrust, take the fans out of the core, integrate them into the, well, the fuselage of the body, and just use a turbine to generate the power for the fans. I think to Sean, the work that you and John are doing, not that it's got any similarity to this, but you know, in some ways, you're taking an idea and developing it, trying to develop it into you know, a commercially viable product. Can you identify with projects like this, or does it just really represent something so different from what you're doing?
No, absolutely. And I completely 100% agree with what Robert said. Projects like this, I always hope the best for that, you know, that they do come to fruition. And even if they don't, I love the fact that we can still rely on people to come up with better ways of doing things. And that's kind of where this stemmed from. When I had been thinking about this idea, it was always, how can I make it better, and what type of aircraft would I use if I were an aircraft owner? And I think that's always where the best ideas stem from.
I get the sense that these kinds of things don't just come about in an instant, that oftentimes they represent maybe even years of thought and pondering and that sort of thing before they start to take form. I mean, is it the same with you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, we didn't really start working on this project until about a little less than a year ago, after I was retired from the military. But I can tell you, before then, you know, ever since my teenage years, I'd been already thinking about something like this. You know, drawing, just sketching, and thinking about an airplane that I would use if I had the ability to own one.
Right.
I think that's always the case. It's years and hours of dreaming.
All right. Well, soon, before too long, we'll talk some more about how you've been able to start to turn that dream of yours into a reality.
Absolutely.
Before we do that, just a couple more news stories. One is from the Washington Post. No clipping these wings. David, this is an example of how broken things are, I think. Last year, the United States Air Force wanted to retire planes that it thought were unneeded in order to cut their budget. But the U.S. governors and the U.S. Congress, they had their own ideas, and the Air Force was ordered not to cut the planes that they didn't want.
The Air Force actually was taking a serious look at aircraft it should retire and no longer need. And believe it or not, some of those were my beloved C-130s. That being said, a lot of them were from Air National Guard units. And governors do not like losing their guard units. I understand that completely because we had a huge fight here in Pennsylvania when we closed Willow Grove. They wanted the Pennsylvania Air National Guard to keep its 4A-10s at the end of the unit. But so what this article outlines is the Air Force saying, we need to make cuts due to sequester. Here's what we're cutting. And Congress and governors and everyone coming back and saying, you can't do that. We need those. So the most amazing stat that David Ignatius publishes in this is talking about congressional revision tilts the overall cuts towards active duty forces, i.e. the folks who were supposed to keep the country safe. The Air Force originally proposed that in fiscal year 2017, it would cut 7,400 guard and reserve positions and 4,200 active duty slots. Instead, after Congress got a hold of it, the active duty forces were going to be slashed by 6,100 people, and the guard and will lose only 1,400 billets, and the reserves will lose only 1,900. Basically, Congress completely reversed the whole. They're, in order to save the guard and the reserves, they're killing the active duty forces. So, I mean, if we're going to have an all-reserve force, great, but they're not thinking it through, and sometimes the people who are making the decisions are the expert on the topics.
Sean, you are in the Air Force. You were a pilot in the Air Force. Does this kind of thing make you crazy when we see politicians dictating, you know, how the Air Force is going to operate?
Yeah, I mean, kind of. You also have to understand that at least in the Air Force, for pilots, only 2% of the entire officer base are pilots. And so you have to think about all the other types of jobs that are out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can only speak for pilots, but it's difficult. You know, even before I was medically retired, they were already, you know, cutting people and not promoting people because of budget cuts. And it's hard to see. You know, we have some really, really smart and good people working in the military. And when you see them go due to budget cuts, it bugs you quite a bit.
Somehow, I don't think the situation is gonna change much when there's politics involved. It just doesn't ever seem to get better. Maybe it only gets worse. All right, just as our final story, this is an example of another way. We've been talking about in on and off sort of developing new technologies in aviation. There's another way to do it. And NASA is trying a different way. This is from a NASA press release. And we also got an article from listener Patrick Wiggins, who sent us something on this as well. The press release is NASA partners with Ohio nonprofit on unmanned air challenge. And so this is something called the UAS Operations Challenge, the Unmanned Aircraft Systems Challenge. And there's a $500,000 prize purse. This is focused on developing and demonstrating some key technologies like the ability to sense and avoid other air traffic. So we've talked about drones and UAVs and such quite a bit over the months. And one issue that always comes up, particularly amongst our pilot friends like Rob and others, is the interaction when unmanned vehicles are flying around in the commercial airspace. So NASA, looking to solve some of those problems, is offering this prize. Rob, is this going to make you happy finally when it comes to UAVs?
It's a loaded question.
Let's just say that I'm from Missouri on this one. They're going to have to show me.
Okay.
And seriously, as we talked about last week, I'm not a drone basher philosophically. I just want to make sure that I know how they're going to keep drones from filling the front, the windshield of my airplane someday at, 4,000 feet when I'm on an approach somewhere and someone lost control of a drone. I just don't want to see that.
So if you come up with a great idea for how to address that problem, Rob, you can make yourself $500,000 richer.
Well,
which would pay for tuition.
That would just about cover your daughter.
Good point. My daughter's starting college out in Los Angeles here in another month, and the tuition's a little pricey. So we're going to be passing the old hat here, I think.
Yeah, we may have to. Or you may have to.
All
right. All right, well, we'll put links in the show notes to more about this UAS Airspace Operations Challenge. It's kind of interesting. It might be worth following, so you can check the show notes for those.
I could add some color to the NASA story if you want.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's actually really interesting that NASA is adopting what a lot of the tech industry is trying to do right now, which is actually throwing out competitions to literally kind of crowdsource some new thinking.
Mm.
And you're seeing that in a lot of the, in the tech industry. And I think that it's a good sign. I think they're looking beyond their traditional sort of pool of talent. It's open to students, obviously, but it's open to the private industry. But I think, there's two things at play here. One is, they definitely want to try to find a unique idea that's probably a new approach to how we could manage this. It's probably going to come from a 17-year-old somewhere.
No doubt.
But I was going to say that the second part of it, I think, is it's actually trying to, I think there's a tremendous amount of focus right now on clean tech. There's a huge amount of focus on, what's happening in Silicon Valley. I really think they're trying to engage smart people and get them interested in aerospace.
Yeah, that's a great point. I hadn't really kind of drawn that analogy to the crowdsourcing we see in so many other areas. But yeah, it does seem to be a good way to generate some fantastic aviation and to get more people involved in trying to find creative solutions than just the employees of a company or the employees of NASA and so forth, the usual researchers. So yeah, I think it's a great approach.
It just expands the talent pool, and if it can create some university students to take a real interest in this type of project, I think that it's an interesting blend in that it's an unmanned. How do you deal with the unmanned aircraft? Yeah. This is definitely a technology solution, but I think it at least spurs people and maybe kind of helps attract some of the talent into this industry.
All right, very good.
And Max, keep in mind that aviation has a long history of prizes, from Lindbergh crossing, flying solo across the North Atlantic, to the Anzari Prize, which got Burt Rutan into orbit.
Yeah, money seems to be a strong motivator.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Burt still talks about it.
Yeah. All right, again, we're speaking with Sean Gillette and John Narroway. Guys, tell us about how the name of your company originated, since it doesn't seem to have either of your last names associated with it.
Sure, yeah. Well, my last name is Gillette, so I figured that there would be some complications with the larger Gillette.
That and they've already trademarked, Mach 1, Mach 2, Mach 3.
Right, yeah, exactly. So, and I wish I was already part of that that family, but besides that,
that would have been a close shave if you had been.
quit with the cutting remarks there, Rob.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Saker stems from it's a type of falcon that I've always been fond of ever since I was a kid. It's that simple.
So let's talk about the aircraft a little bit. This is a two-seat aircraft. It's got more than a little resemblance to a military fighter, and it's a twin engine jet as well.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a two seat tandem 11,500-pound aircraft, two engines pushing out hopefully about a little over 7,000 pounds of thrust. So good thrust-to-weight ratio. And it's currently looking at the capabilities of 90 knots on the slow end to, you know, 0.99 Mach on the high end, and the ability to fly at towards 1,600 nautical miles, and with extended pods up to 2,200 nautical miles.
And what's the sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, of course, you know, 0.99 Mach is the MMO for it. It'll be cruising around 0.95 Mach.
That's pretty zippy.
Yeah, no, it's the new Citation 10 was at 0.9325, so our cruise is going to be faster than their MMO.
Wow.
Which is a big deal for us.
And the service ceiling of this?
It'll be 45,000 feet, pressurized to 8,000. Kind of just basically a normal business jet.
Wow.
And the interior is going to be stylized to represent that as well. Granted, it'll be, you know, you're looking at two cockpits, but we're doing our best to make it as luxury of an aircraft as possible.
Rob, could you see yourself flying in one of these?
Not really. It's way too deep for a guy my age. You know, I mean, what? Come on. I mean, think about this, guys. I mean, I would pull up on the ramp at Palwaukee in a jet that looks like this with a cool helmet on and kind of step out. And
everybody would laugh at you.
You know, yeah, they'd say, oh, there's that kid, you know, another fancy trans. Are you kidding? Of course I want this. In fact, Sean, I had a chance years ago. Oh, this must be, this must be at least 15, 18 years ago. I used to write for a magazine called Omni, which was a science magazine that is no longer produced. It was produced by the same company that produces Penthouse.
Okay.
And they sent me down to St. Louis to go fly the BD-10. And,
really?
It was really neat. It was a, you know, it
was. That must have been an awesome experience.
It wasn't very sophisticated at all because it was just, it was a Jim Beatty special and it was not anything to look at, but it was pretty cool. Of course, the downside to that particular story is that about a month after I flew that airplane, the guy that I flew with was killed because the airplane broke up in mid-flight. No big deal. You know, just thought I'd throw that in there for whatever.
You know, and that was a sad story too. I don't know if you guys have dug into that at all. It's just from the research I've done, at least I heard that the vertical tails didn't have the correct twist on it in order to support that speed at the higher end, and that's what happened. So, yeah, it's quite unfortunate. And if that plane were successful, I think we'd be living a whole different world right now, because that was the key to a very different market, the one that we're trying to go after right now.
I mean, it's really a performance-based market that we're trying to tap into. It's the, you know, if we try to draw the automotive analogy, it's kind of like you could, McLaren has their Formula One team and they have a lot of technology that they put into the F1 cars. But then they go and they develop essentially the rich man's Formula One car, which is their F1 street
the road
model.
Car, yes.
A road car, yeah. So, you know, you get a lot of the performance, but, you know, you get the leather seats instead of the carbon fiber, you know, solid seat. You know, we've sort of taken a page from that type of learning where we're like, you know, people really are interested in performance. How do we turn it into a rich, luxurious experience at the same time? And we think there's a huge opportunity in that marketplace.
Absolutely.
Now, this
well, you know, we... Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Rob.
Well, I was going to say we spoke a little earlier about the... what was the other, the Javelin?
Javelin.
We talked earlier about the Javelin and the fact that did not really come to fruition. Do you think it was just bad timing or was it a bad, you know, I don't want to say a bad design, but was it just not adequate to be up to that kind of a job?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I think they had a great idea and a great basis. I think, just like what you mentioned, it was a very unfortunate timing issue. Right when they were seeking their last round of funding to production, you know, it was 2008, you know, late 2007, early 2008, right when the market started the downfall, and everybody just kind of dried up, and they couldn't get the money to move forward. So it was kind of unfortunate. With that being said, they were extremely successful in proving that this kind of market is out there. They had the numbers vary on the different reports that you read, but they had over 120 or 150 confirmed orders and up to, I think, 500 unconfirmed orders. And so something for an airplane like this, that many people were interested in not only purchasing, but pre-ordering an aircraft of that nature is pretty substantial.
And we're hoping that there's still people out there looking for a plane.
Right. <You know?
laughs> Yeah. Seeing people sort of like, you know, oh, shoot, I didn't get my dream vehicle. Like, I didn't get my dream plane. So now, you know, that's where we're trying to maybe get to that market and hope that it's the right timing.
Yeah, so the listeners that had an order, you know, please contact us.
Yep.
David, did you have something?
Yeah, Sean, a clarification. This isn't a home built, right? You're not giving this out as a kit. This is going to be, you're going to fly to the factory and pick it up.
Absolutely, yeah. No, this is, we don't see the kit built market being nearly as successful as a Part 23 FAA and EASA certified aircraft. So that does mean that it's a little more complex in terms of testing and certification and takes a little bit more time in order to deliver the product. But, you know, we want to deliver the best product available. And for us, that's a fully certified aircraft.
So let's talk a little bit about the components, the engines and the avionics and things like that. You're using the Williams FJ44, two of them for a power, the Dash 4 model, which is, I guess, the largest, the big FJ44 model.
Correct. Yeah, and just to confirm, you know, nothing has been solidified with Williams. We've just been using the FJ44-4 specs in order to do our preliminary design. But if we move forward with it, that is the engine that we are looking to use, correct?
And that engine shows up in a lot of other places, right? That's in the Pilatus PC-24 and the
CJ-4.
The CJ-4, the Piper mm-hmm. Jet, the Hawker 200.
Yeah, it's a solid, solid engine. The thrust that it puts out is perfect for aircraft because it provides the perfect balance for performance and fuel efficiency for us. So,
and how about the avionics? What are you using for the avionics suite?
Avionics are still to be determined. However, you know, we have had some talks with Garmin here and there about it. Nothing solid again. It's just there's a lot more engineering to be done before something like that can be solidified.
Okay.
But you know, we're looking at state-of-the-art touchscreen technology with a heads-up display, preferably single panel, something like you'd see in the F-35. Just due to the fact that it is, you know, tandem center seating. So we want the primary flight display in the center of the pilot and not to the side, like in a G1000 setup where you would have two screens, left and right.
Control column or side stick?
It is going to be a center stick. The side stick has some major complexities to it, and we wanted the aircraft to be as foolproof as possible. And in order to do that, we went with the center stick just because the systems that come with this are less complex and have a lot better chance of some good redundancy systems attached to it. When you move into a side stick configuration, you're a fully hydraulic system or a fly-by-wire system, which not only is extremely expensive to develop and certify, but also, like I was saying, that we want this airplane to be fitted for not necessarily the you know, the 500-hour pilot, but somebody who is an average pilot that flies you know, 100 or so hours a year or a little more than that, and has the ability to move up from a high-performance piston aircraft.
Was it difficult to locate funding for this project?
Well, currently it's all been privately funded through myself, and we're taking a slightly different approach to receiving funding for this. In the past, aircraft startups have used the mentality of, we need to get funding from this guy and that guy and that guy and this guy and this guy, small chunks here and there. And eventually they have enough to really get started. But when it comes to big milestone achievements, they don't have the funding to move forward. And when you're dealing with a project like this, you need the funding to go through those milestones without any hiccups, especially in the timeline process. You know, you saw what happened to ATG Javelin program. They had a solid base, but when they're looking for more funding, they were just unfortunate with the timing. And we don't want that to happen to us. So we've actually been looking at a total project fund coming from one funding source, which we're hopefully coming close to closing soon. It's been a challenge. It's definitely not easy.
But again, like Sean was saying, though, it is a different approach. We're not doing the stage by stage. You know, hit the milestone. Okay, now we have to go quickly raise the money so we can move to the next stage. You know, this way, there's what we're hoping is that we're showing the investors that we've thought through it, and then we're also showing the customers that, you know, we will deliver the product. And I think that's key to us as well, is that, you know, a startup will actually deliver.
Yeah, it feels more like a funding method that is more likely to result in success than the sort of the incremental approach, if you can pull it off.
Yeah, I mean, if we have the funding to go through certification and production, it just solidifies it for everybody. And not only that, but it severely increases our timeline and shortens it quite a bit.
So let's talk about that timeline a little bit. Where are we? Well, where are you in this in this project timeline, and what's ahead?
Sure. The preliminary design is complete, and we've started on the detail design. We are looking to get the aircraft certified and into production 2019. We think that's fairly aggressive yet conservative in nature at the same time. So
yeah, these things do take they take years. They take a long time.
If I could ask a question about that, actually, I mean, you know, I don't know how many times over the years that we've been doing this show, guys, we've heard stories about whether it's general aviation airplanes or Airbus or Boeing or Bombardiers or whatever, that in the end we say, boy, building airplanes is not easy, because there are always those things that pop up that no one's expecting. So how do you intend to kind of prepare yourself for the real world of getting an airplane certified these days with the FAA? I mean, is it a class you take, or do you do yoga, or what's it going to be?
Yoga does help, certainly keeps the frustration at bay. But you know, I think our timeline, here's the deal: we don't want to put out any numbers or any dates that we can't commit to. And we can't succeed with. Granted, I'm sure there are going to be issues that pop up that we're going to have to deal with. But that's why in our timeline, we've said, what's the best balance between taking the most aggressive route while leaving room for error? And we believe that we've come up with the best route possible for that.
Let's talk now about the big question that we haven't specifically addressed, and that is, how much will one of these guys cost us?
Well, the base price we're looking at are around $5 million, which we feel is perfect for this type of aircraft. With certain options that you can pick out yourselves, including optional ejection seats, that number can rise to about $7 million, depending on what you choose. Ejection seats are not cheap, so those are probably the more pricey items. But
are you serious?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, it.
I mean, this is going to have ejection seats.
It's an optional package.
Wow.
And so for those people that want the extra safety margin, that are willing to deal with the insurance hassle associated with having ejection seats, that is definitely going to be an option for them.
Can you buy those things off the shelf?
They're just going to take some negotiations in order to work with a couple different vendors and achieve the best price possible for our customers. But it's possible for civilian aircraft to have them. So.
No kidding! Wow, are there others that do that you're aware of?
You know, not that I'm aware of. I know that there are decommissioned military aircraft that still have hot seats.
Sure,
but those came from military lines.
Yeah.
So other than that, I'm not aware of any other civilian aircraft that comes off the line with new ejection seats now.
Yeah, interesting. I wonder if that would limit that option to U.S. sales, or if that's something that's export controlled.
And it's going to be a slight learning process for us as well, as far as politics are concerned. But ejection seats are definitely a good safety option for those that really crave it.
Fascinating.
Sean, speaking of international sales, where do you think the market is? The market you're just gearing towards the United States, or are you trying to broaden across globally?
Yeah, no, absolutely. We're seeking out the global market here. And just from our announcements a little over a month ago, we've already received interest from all over the world, from all countries that you can think of. And of course, it's going to be a certified aircraft, so before we can deliver aircraft to certain countries, we will have to make sure that they're certified in that area. But besides that, our main focus is going to be FAA and EASA initially, and then we'll start going from there. So,
how about pre-orders?
Pre-orders, we have had some. I don't want to divulge too much, but we do have some interest already. And we're currently in the negotiations with people that are placing pre-orders currently.
What about training? How are you going to train people to fly this thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So as a turbofan aircraft, we all know that it requires a type rating. So those people that have roughly around 750 to 1,000 hours, we see will be qualified to earn a type rating in this insurance reasons, that is. And so the process is going to be very similar to any other business jet that you see on the market these days. So a Phenom 100 to, Cessna Mustang, you go to a type rating training course, a couple weeks with ground and simulator training. And our plan is to offer a few hours in the actual aircraft with an instructor as well before they step into their own aircraft. And fly off from our factory. So,
where do you think the simulator is going to come from?
We've already talked with a couple different manufacturers. There are some really good people out there that produce simulators. So, Simcom, SimuFlight, Flight Safety, all produce a quality product. And we are still in discussions about whether to outsource that. That type rating, or to hold it in-house at our facility.
So I know Rob is probably just itching to get on your list of early test pilots, or maybe not test pilots, but at least review pilots.
Review pilots, yes. Thank you for saying that.
All right. Absolutely. Yeah.
They pay other people that know a whole lot more about engineering to go out and see what this thing will do.
Well, it's... We'll be glad to have you. Absolutely.
Yeah. Sean, I guess we haven't talked about what it looks like. We've talked about a twin turbofan, but you want to describe in your own words what we're going to see sitting on the apron?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess some people have described it as a mix between like an F-15 and an F-35 or an F-22 and an F-35. It's basically the look of what a modern fighter takes hold right now, including the intakes, the styling of the nose, twin tail, which actually came about due to the fact that we wanted the slow speed handling qualities to be good enough for, like I was saying, the average pilot. And canopies are going to be kind of unique as it stands right now. The design is a forward opening and in a aft opening canopy, and that came about because when I was flying the T-38, I got so tired of hitting my head on the canopy as I of the airplane that we put that into effect here. So you're going to see an aircraft 41 feet long, with a wingspan of about 25 feet. And just a little bit, if you're familiar with the L-39, it's going to be slightly larger than an L-39.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good frame of reference.
Right, exactly. It's standing height. You'll be, if you're about 6 feet tall, you'll be standing right at the base of the canopy. So it's a fairly substantial looking aircraft when it's sitting on the ramp. And that's what we wanted it to be. It was specifically designed for that as well. Nothing against the BD-10, but we didn't want this to look like a kit-built small aircraft. We wanted it to be a substantial aircraft that people, climb into, not step into.
All right, fantastic. This has been really interesting. Can you tell us where our listeners can go to learn more about the Saker?
Right now, for just the specs and a little bit more information about it, you can go to Saker, S-A-K-E-R, aircraft.com. If you are interested in just learning a lot more or chatting with Sean or myself, pre-ordering or just getting more of the technical feel of it, what is it again, Sean? It's info?
Yeah, info at sakeraircraft.com.
Yeah.
And we also have a Facebook page. It's just Facebook / Saker Aircraft, as well as a Twitter that we're keeping posted with buzz around the internet as it comes along.
And the buzz has been really interesting, actually. It's funny, Sean and I sort of, we made the announcement a month ago, and it sort of went through the regular channels that we expect. And all of a sudden, with Twitter and all these amazing things these days, all of a sudden you start seeing a lot of Korean characters, and then Saker S1, and then a lot of I guess like places like the Netherlands are picked up on it, and the stories are out there, and it's really just been an amazing, just for our own personal experience, just watching what we thought was kind of just. Yeah, there might be some interest in this, and people might just suddenly see it going around the world and people talking about it and it being in, some pretty major magazines, over in Europe and in Asia. So it definitely shows that, it's definitely there's a global interest for something like this, and definitely, people love aviation everywhere.
So, John, let me ask you a really awkward question, because we're so good at doing that here. Was it hard... When Sean approached you about coming on as the marketing guy, was it hard for you to say, okay, wait, so you've got an idea for a kind of a personal fighter jet, but you don't have the money yet, you haven't designed the airplane, but you want me to come and work for you? Sure. I just wondered, was there any reluctance on your part to jump in?
Interestingly enough, we were introduced through a mutual that's been helping with some parts of the business, and I actually I asked a lot of the dumb questions, like, you really think this could work? Do you, but my questions are also, why do you think you can do this?
And what was
Sean,
the answer?
Sean, why do you think, I asked Sean, what makes you think you can do this? How do you persevere through the next 4 years? And not everybody's going to say nice things about it. And how are you going to get through it all? And he just came back to me with just one line. He just goes, "People underestimate my love of this industry." And it was just like, "You got me, man. You got me." It's like Tom Cruise, "You had me at hello."
It was one of those.
But also, it was the questions of what's the track history of similar projects. Who are you talking to? Who do you have sort of as your mentors in the background that are going to help guide you through it? When you start adding up the mentors, the people that are the whole story of Javelin to me was a real eye opener. But there's definitely a market here, and you start looking at it all, and you go, it just seems, why are we the only guys thinking about this? And I think there's a huge opportunity. If you look at the private, I look at it as with a bit of a with my automotive background, I always try to do a car analogy. If you look at the private jet business right now, it's like guys are really excited about minivans with leather seats that fly. And this is really kind of like, okay, so let's give somebody something that's a little bit more like a Ferrari or a Bugatti Veyron. And that's where it really sort of captures the imagination. So, yeah, we're not saying bad things about private jets. No names, wow. But you know, it does feel like to me. It felt like minivans with leather seats.
Wow,
is that a bad thing? So that ends my career with Saker.
No, not at all. I quickly just wanted to point out one thing, that one of the reasons why I wanted to do this as well is that I saw the industry going in a certain direction, and that was the fact that the era of excess and overkill is gone. And what I mean by that is, you know, the Citation 10, the G4, G5, taking two people 700 miles somewhere and burning a lot of kerosene and Jet A is done. You know, I think it was 2009 or 2000, BAA came out with that study that said the average number of passengers per flight is 1 to 2, and the average distance is 1500 nautical miles. And you look at what we're doing with Saker and the S1, that fits exactly in that profile. So we know that this jet isn't for absolutely everybody, but we think that it will have a great impact on those that will need it. So
The one question I wanted to ask was, is it going to be aerobatic?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a positive 7, negative 3 G aircraft, fully aerobatic. You know, for the normal standard of aircraft of the stature, you know, nothing like Lomshavox or tumbles or anything like that. But certainly all
but the stuff. The L39 range.
Yeah, exactly. You know, aileron rolls, loops, that sort of thing. Something that people can have fun with on the weekend.
All right, very good. We want to thank you. You've been listening to Sean Gillette and John Narroway from Saker Aircraft. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us on the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for having us.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, July the 8th, 2013, folks.
Oh, g'day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 256. And Grant, quite chilly here this week, I must say. It's been quite frosty. I can't wait for that summer weather to come back. Oh, we're not supposed to talk about the weather, are we?
No, you've just made a major faux pas and you've talked about the weather. But while we're talking about the weather, I find the winter cold is not too bad a thing. So long as there's not a lot of wind and rain, I can go flying and have a wonderful flight because the balloon performs really well when it's cold.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Oh, well, like the joys of a pre-recorded segment where Max can't do anything about it. Anyway.
Well, you may cut our pay.
You may well do too. Okay, on to aviation news, and no sooner had the Airplane Geeks show been released last week than my good friends at Tiger Airways came out with news of a rebranding.
They have come out and they've rebranded themselves from Tiger Airways Australia to Tiger Air Australia. And it's even got a new logo and everything. There's no more leaping, pouncing cat.
Yeah, I wonder if they'll change their call sign from GoCat, which is what they use when they're talking to air traffic control.
Yeah, it certainly causes some amusement to air traffic controllers when they come online. And GoCat, yes, as we've said a number of times, it's the brand of a cat food here in Australia.
Absolutely.
Yay!
Now, of course, this is all part of the rebranding that's going on as they're increasingly integrating themselves in with Virgin Australia, as we've been reporting over the course of this year. That's been an ongoing saga, but it's been approved, and that's in the process of being finalised this month, I think, in fact. Their CEO, Rob Sharp, did a media conference this week. Quite comical. Let's have a listen.
Today marks an important milestone for the airline, and I'm pleased to say today that we have news of a major brand overhaul. From today, we'll operate as Tiger Air, and we'll be integrating the brand into all our aircraft fleet, domestic terminals, and across all the customer touch points, as from today. The Tiger Air brand incorporates fantastic value, punctuality, and a genuinely warm service with the customer at its heart.
He must be kidding, mustn't he, Grant? I wonder if that will include putting an actual customer service department to take complaints. It's only been 5 years. I'm still waiting, Tiger Air.
You are so Dutch when it comes to carrying a grudge, man.
You're absolutely right. Well, I mean, that's good. Rebranding, well, okay, that's one thing. I don't know that it'll make much difference to their day-to-day operations unless they're going to pick up their game when he talks about customer service. Well, at least in my experience, it doesn't really exist there. But, you know, hey, I'm willing to give them another chance. No, actually, I'm not.
No, you'll never give them another chance. But, mate, the key thing here is, by the way, notice that part of the rebranding and the new working closely with Virgin and so on is they think it'll take about 12 months for the restructuring to start delivering financial benefits, and that it's going to take even longer before the budget carrier is profitable.
Well, you know, we want to see them profitable. I just want to see them provide good service. So let's hope that this first step, rebranding to Tiger Air, is a successful one for them. Now, Grant, moving on to matters military, and the Royal Australian Navy has been in the process of purchasing a new fleet of MH-60R Romeo helicopters, and the first one of those in Royal Australian Navy colours has taken to the air over in Connecticut.
Yes, not too far from Max, I believe, in Stratford, Connecticut. The first of 24 units has taken to the air, doing its check flight, and now that the contractor flight acceptance stage is completed, it's going to be transferred over to New York State for integration of mission systems and sensors.
Yeah, it's interesting. Defence Material Minister Mike Kelly Grant, is he still a Minister for Defence Material? I suppose he is after there's been so many reshuffles lately, but he says here in a statement that a further three Royal Australian Navy Romeos are currently in various stages of assembly, with the first two planned to be handed over to the Navy in December 2013. So that'll be exciting when they come. They're a very mean-looking machine, mate.
They certainly pack a punch, mate, and I had a lot of fun recently re-watching our video we recorded with a US Navy Romeo crew back at Avalon 2011. That was very interesting, and I really enjoyed being in the cockpit, not just because it got me out of the cold wind.
Absolutely. Well, Grant, a wonderful self-promotion there. We should make sure that Max puts a link to that video in the show notes.
Well, I certainly hope he does.
Okay, let's move back to the airlines, and good news for Simba the Wonder Dog, if he chooses to come out here and spend some time, you know, getting reacquainted with me out here in Australia, since he likes me more than he does Rob. And if he flies with Virgin, Grant, he can now get frequent flyer points.
Yeah, I think this is the tigerization of Virgin starting to come forward. I'm really gobsmacked about this one, mate. But yeah, Virgin are offering frequent flyer points for pets who travel either in the cabin or under floor in the hold. Yeah, they reap frequent flyer points. And the fun bit is that the owner gets to use them.
Oh, jeez, everyone's a winner, Grant.
I'm just gobsmacked about this one. I'm like, oh, man, this is their luggage. What's next? My suitcase is going to get frequent flyer points?
Yeah. Yeah, no, this is wonderful. I'm going to squeeze Charlie, the official PCDU dog, into my luggage every time we travel now on company business.
Oh, hey, he's got to be an IATA specified carry cage if he's underneath, and, you know, you have some fun trying to get him into the cabin with you.
Yes, absolutely. My dog would demand nothing less than being in the cabin. No cargo hold carry box for him.
Well, they're only doing this for cats and dogs at the moment. They haven't extended it to aquarium fish or aviary birds, so your budgies and guppies are not yet part of the scene, mate.
And no carrying tigers, if I had to guess.
Honestly, I think it'd be great if Simba actually did come down, because we could take him out and introduce him to the joys of chasing kangaroos.
Yeah, he'd love that. You know, he'd catch one, then we could eat it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Tasty.
Oh, dear, wonderful. Oh, well, let's go back and look at the regional airlines. We don't often talk about Rex Regional Express, but they're in the news this week. They've actually been awarded the highest ranking for best performing airline in the Asia-Pacific region and the second best such airline in the world. So well done to Rex.
They're a pretty hardworking airline. They've taken over a number of smaller regional performers, especially after the Ansett collapse back in 2001. They keep working hard to expand and come out on the top of the pile. They've put a lot of effort into this. They're just recently purchasing another seven of the Saab 340Bs, and they've also put in a new full-motion flight simulator at the Australian Airline Pilot Academy in Wagga Wagga, which is where they churn out a lot of their cadet pilots.
Okay, so Rex is actually a very large operator of the Saab 340 aircraft. In fact, the number is approaching 40. Well, it depends on where you read, Grant. Some articles say 33 and some say 40, but I believe that either way, it makes them the largest Saab 340 operator in the world. So if that is true, that's fantastic. And they perform a very important service getting around to many regional areas of Australia that otherwise wouldn't have an airline service. So good on them for that.
Kudos to Rex, cool airline. And as we know, a couple of people who fly for them, they're definitely cool. They're keeping our friends employed. That's got to be a good thing.
Absolutely fantastic. Now, just as we wrap up here, Grant, we mentioned last week Ryan Campbell's Teen World flight, and we played a snippet of an interview that I recorded with Ryan just before he departed. I've now recorded another interview with him, which we'll put a link to in the show notes too, which I recorded with Ryan from Hilo in Hawaii. And as this one goes to air, he will have completed the next leg of his flight, which of course is across the Pacific from Hawaii to Van Nuys in California. We'll be hoping to catch up with Ryan again. Now he's doing a couple of stops, I believe, in California. Then he's heading down to Texas, Tennessee, and then up to Oshkosh, spending a week there, and then heading over to Maine, up through Canada, and then across the Atlantic. So if you're going to be in the States, I think we mentioned it last week, but really want to support Ryan in his bid to become the youngest person to fly solo around the world. And he's doing a fantastic job. Grant, when I spoke to him the other day, he sounded very confident, very happy within himself, and very happy with the Cirrus SR-22 aircraft that he's flying around the world. So good on him, and we just remind our listeners here that you can catch up with what Ryan is up to at his website, including live tracking at teenworldflight.com.
That's the one, mate, and I've got to say he's picked a great spot in the world to have a bit of a break and get everything ready for the longest over water leg, which is, of course, between Hawaii and California. Hilo is a wonderful place, mate. I spent a couple of weeks in Hilo a few years back. Really enjoyed it. It's a very relaxed part of Hawaii. It's not the tourist yuppie kind of zones. So good on Ryan for spending a few days and getting ready for the long leg.
Yes, and Hilo, as we all know, is named after one of the navigators or pilots in Battlestar Galactica. David Vanderhoof will understand.
I think I'm going to try and claim prior art on that one and kibosh that discussion, but anyhow.
Well, there you go. On that rather geeky note, I think we'll end it this week. We'll be back next week. Until then, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm the dubious Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
All right, as we mentioned, Peter Johnson is back. Peter Johnson's all married up now, and he somehow found a little bit of time to put together a little Across the Pond segment for us. So here's Peter.
Hi there. It's great to be back in the fold. It's been quite odd not having any internet or access to any aviation and aerospace material for a couple of weeks. In fact, it was quite nice to take a break and have the chance to refocus. So first, a big thank you to all the positive messages I've received. And no, Rob, we weren't camped at the end of the runway at Heathrow. In fact, we went to southwest France in search of the sun and some great food, both of which were pretty elusive, but that's another story. We hired a villa near Bergerac, and while sitting next to the pool, we saw a lot of local GA traffic, and I later discovered that we were less than a mile from the local airport, which coincidentally had a very good restaurant on the site. Unfortunately, when I visit, both appeared to be closed, but it whet my appetite for understanding a little bit more about French general aviation. I've tried for the past 3 years to get someone to come onto the show to give this French perspective, but we failed. So if you're listening to this and think you'd like to talk about GA in France, drop us a line to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Anyway, I was also lucky enough to see some local gliding, and the aviation highlight of the trip was a flight of three French Air Force Rafales screaming across the valley just above us. As I said, we were renting a villa near a place called Saint-Foy, which is situated in the famous wine region close to Bordeaux and Saint-Emilion. And a local drive through the countryside saw me come across something that was quite amazing. And that was the nose section of an Aérospatiale Caravelle. Now, David featured the Caravelle a while ago on the history segment, and as you can see from the picture on the show notes, I became intrigued as to why a nose section of a Caravelle was sitting in the middle of a remote farm in a wine region field. So when I got back, I did a bit of research, and it turns out that the aircraft is a Super Caravelle Model 10B. That was scrapped, and the front section was purchased by a local collector. I'm not sure what it's for, but it now sits in this field. Now, this aircraft's got a rich history, and after being built as a Model 10B prototype in 1964, it was delivered to Iberia as ECBDC. It later transferred to Aviarco, also in Spain, before being sold to Aeroloid of Germany. It was taken out of service in 2000 and scrapped at Bordeaux Airport, about 30-odd miles away, I think. Now, I remember seeing Aviarco Caravelles at London Gatwick in the late 70s, and although I'm not 100% certain, Its registration then, which was Echo Charlie, Charlie Alpha Echo, is familiar to me, and I think I've got a bond with this aircraft because I think I saw it all those years ago. And the fact is, it's also the same age as me, but that's no coincidence. So if anyone knows what the eventual use of this nose section will be, why not let us know? I just thought that it would be interesting doing a bit of research on an aircraft like this that I saw probably so many years ago and has turned up in a very unexpected place. I also thought I'd just mention a book that I took with me, and I confess to not yet completing it, but I thought I'd give it a shout out, as the Kindle version cost me less than a dollar, and it's called The Smell of Kerosene, A Test Pilot's Odyssey. Now, maybe David will have read this. It's by Donald L. Malik, and it's his story of flying from his early days as a US Navy pilot, and includes his carrier training and later test flying, through to joining NASA as a test pilot and flying the Apollo LLRV. He also managed to fly the YF-12 Blackbird. It's a really great read. I'm really enjoying it. And as for value for money, you can't really argue with that. So finally, don't forget, if you fly in France and you want to share your experience with us, let us know. But in the meantime, I'll have some of our regular guests coming back onto the segment to give us some regional updates and news from around the patch. Oh, and Rob, those video clips, let's just say what goes on honeymoon stays on honeymoon. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
All right. It's great to have Peter back.
So he's entered the world of the married.
Yeah.
Wow. Do we know his new wife's name?
No, Peter, you got to send us some wedding photos, too. We'll post those. Well, maybe you won't post those, but
we don't know the boss's name. Can you please let us know? I mean, the your wife's name.
Yeah. Same thing.
He'll find that part out later.
So I've got the photo of the front end of this caravel. It's really kind of interesting to see this thing sitting there. We'll put that in the show notes, so take a look at that.
Hi, this is Igor Sikorsky III over Bradford Camps in Skyhawk 462901. You're listening to Airplane Geeks.
All right, let's move on to listener mail. Let's start with Christopher, who writes from Bergen, Norway. He says, using the Autobahn as a field runway. After hearing you guys talk about that, I remembered a video I saw on YouTube showing this during an exercise in 1984. Very interesting, seeing everything from C-130s to A-10s and F-16s landing and taking off from a highway. He says, here in Norway, unlike our neighbors in Sweden, we don't have such long stretches of highway for that kind of operation. But during the Cold War, the Royal Norwegian Air Force yearly trained for operating out of Norwegian short field runways using F-16s. He says, with the runways usually as short as 800 meters, or about 2,600 feet. Needless to say, they could not carry a lot of payload or fuel for that kind of operation. Mostly a centerline tank and two AIM-9s on tips. The drag chute was a real savior for the landing, he says. They stopped these operations during the 90s, so sadly I never got to experience this when I was in the Air Force. Would have been a sight. So we have a link to that YouTube video that shows the operations on the runway. It is kind of cool to watch that. And he also commented about the Enola Gay. Last week we talked about the Enola Gay at the Air and Space Museum that we were commenting on. And he says about the Enola Gay display possibly being offensive to people. He says, yes, it is an object that represents all the horror of war and that of the atom bomb. But that is also why it needs to be displayed. It's important, he says, to remember what it represents, and that we don't forget that, so that we hopefully don't end up in similar situation. He says, I'm lucky enough to have visited the Peace Park at Hiroshima and witnessed the remains that still stand today and see what the bomb did. And I really hope to be able to visit the Enola Gay at the Udvar-Hazy Center on time in the future, or sometime in the future, maybe the next Be a Pilot Day. So he says, also another theme I have a comment for is the ongoing talk about in-flight deployment of thrust reversers. This is a major feature of the C-17 transporter, which can put its engines in thrust reverse, giving it the possibility to get down fast. A neat feature to have when you're entering combat zones to limit the exposure to the threats that exist there. And he says another one is the 737 Classics. They can actually deploy their reversers when passing 10 feet AGL. Again, he's got a YouTube video with that as evidence. Thanks to Christopher for passing those along. I don't know if you guys have seen that video of the 737. It seems like it's really on the ground, pretty close before the thrust reversers deploy, but it's kind of hard to see. It's a newer model 737 with a CFM56, not one of the old JT8D powered 737s. So I guess
I better say that I stand corrected when I said I couldn't believe that there would be anybody that would be pulling these engines into reverse while it was still in the air. Of course, I must admit, in the back of my mind, although I didn't say it, I was thinking at 8 or 10,000 feet or something like that. And I did ask. Remember, somebody mentioned the DC-8 could go into reverse.
Right. Yeah.
In fact, I had dinner a couple of days ago with a friend of mine who spent many years as an engineer, a flight engineer on the DC-8, and he told me that the only way they could pull the two inboard engines into reverse was practically an emergency procedure. That's just what this fella told me, and I figured that since he flew the DC-8 a whole heck of a lot more than I did, which was, let's see, zero, I figured I'd listen to him.
Sure, so, defer to him. Anyway. Yeah, so it's been interesting. So we've received quite a lot of interesting information from our listeners about the deployment of thrust reversers off the runway. And it's been interesting. I assume the Saker doesn't have thrust reversers.
Well, you know, maybe it does not. no, you know, but we do have a huge air brake or speed brake, so you can at least get down really fast and slow down really fast if that's needed. But
and no afterburners, I assume, huh?
Not in the civilian model, no.
No, I don't think Williams offers afterburners for... All right. Thanks, John.
Yeah, no worries.
We heard from Justin Trombley. He's our favorite trucker. He says, this morning I listened to the most recent episode where the listener from Turkey wrote in regarding the Enola Gay comment. He says, I figured I'd throw in my two cents on the matter since you encouraged everyone to do so. So Justin makes a couple of points. He says, primarily, I don't feel that any of you owe an apology to anybody for making the comment about being, quote, excited to see the Enola Gay. And here's his reasons. One, it's an aircraft. You're all aircraft enthusiasts. Why wouldn't you be excited to see it? You seemed equally interested and excited to see the lineup of Cessna aircraft parked outside. And two, it's a living piece of history. Again, why wouldn't you be excited to see it? He says, yes, it's a machine designed for war, and it's an undeniable fact that tens of thousands of people in Hiroshima perished in the mission carried out by that very aircraft, but it played an enormous role in helping to bring the war to an end. Not every day you're going to have the opportunity to see and experience such an important piece of history up close. And then three, to Rob's point, I'm sure any one of you would be equally as interested or excited to see a Zero or an ME-109. Those planes, as well as many other models from the period, killed thousands of Allied soldiers and civilians. Horrible? Yes. But does that make the aircraft themselves any less interesting? I don't feel so. And then finally, he says, I think David's thoughts on the matter are what struck me most. It got me thinking about how things might be if certain events throughout history had never occurred or had gone differently. So thanks for those comments, Justin. We appreciate the feedback. Joe Edwards wrote in, said, Gents, fantastic podcast, eagerly await for Thursdays. He said, the numbering convention of RAF squadrons is a little strange. So some info for David. In a recent podcast, David discussed the Avro Lancaster and the anniversary of the 617 Dambuster squadron raid. However, David called it 617, which is how a U.S. Air Force outfit would have been called, I guess. It's pronounced 617. He says, given David has an amazing attention to detail, thought he would like to know. But then Joe goes on, should point out that it's not always the case with RAF squadrons, as 111 squadron is pronounced, well, 111, not 111. He says the world would be a worse place without the British idiosyncrasies. So thank you, Joe.
And Joe, I do know that, but it's kind of hard when you're trying to read your liner notes to remember all these things. And I always thought it was 111, not 111.
Oh, really? Oh. But it's not 777, though, right? 777.
It's 777, but I believe the squadron has always been known as 111.
Oh, interesting. Okay. We heard from Errol Cabot. He says, interesting coverage in the New Zealand Herald of changes to flight paths into the Auckland International Airport due to making use of GPS-guided descents. He says, I'm sure that fewer residents are impacted by aircraft noise than under existing flight paths. However, some of those experiencing A380s and 737s overhead for the first time aren't seeing the bigger picture. He says, I had noticed different airline activity over my house and saw them as a welcome addition to the Islander turboprops shuttling to and from the nearby Great Barrier Island. I expect these issues to appear wherever flight paths change due to more efficient options being becoming available, for example, next gen. And he sent in a link to the New Zealand Herald article on this, and you can take a look at that. Rich McKinney wrote in, sorry I didn't get to see us at the Udvar Hazy Center this year. He says he'll be at Oshkosh this year, so I hope to see you then. So you might see Rob then. Rich says, a friend of mine asked if I had heard of a new aircraft from the Netherlands that is the next attempt to develop a flying car. It's called the PAL-V. It is, which is PAL-V. He says it's a combination gyrocopter and car. They do have a flying prototype, and if it works commercially, it will be very interesting. Their website is pal-v.com. He says, I think your listeners will enjoy the videos of their initial flights. So, yeah, that's pretty interesting. It's kind of a trike. I mean, it's you know, it's a small but fairly futuristic looking sort of vehicle that seems to perform pretty well on the road, and then converts to this gyrocopter, and off you go with it. It looks pretty exciting. Probably not as expensive as a Saker twin jet, but I'm sure it's, if this thing does come to pass, that it'll be not inexpensive either. All right, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. I want to thank everyone for listening. We want to thank our guests, Sean Gillette and John Narroway from SakerAircraft.com. Thanks, guys, for being on the show.
Thank you guys very much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And you can follow them on Twitter at Saker Aircraft. We want to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron and Steve Fisher. Find them at PlaneCrazyDownUnder.com. Also, Peter Johnson, he's back. You can find him on Twitter as Nascot Hornet. Also, his Aviation Extended podcast at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. Just a quick reminder to everybody, take a look at oshbash.com/vote and vote for your favorite podcasters and new media folks. If you haven't checked that out, please do. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online. Rob Mark, we'll start with you. Where can folks find you?
They can find us on Twitter at Jetwine and jetwine.com on the blog world. And who knows, this week, who knows which media outlet you will see my mug on.
You're kind of everywhere.
Yeah, I'm kind of everywhere. But like I said, it's been quite a busy week.
All right. Thanks, Rob. And David Vanderhoof, where do people find more of you?
They find me on television watching Rob Mark. but besides that, you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com. And, of course, I'm always on Facebook and the Airplane Geeks Facebook page and all sorts of other things. So just shout outs there.
Great. And I'm Max Flight. Look for me on Google Plus and Twitter. And you can also find me at 30,000feet.com. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 256. You can find some photos there, also links to all the sites that we mentioned on the podcast. Be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook, also Google+. And you can also listen to us on Stitcher.com if you want to stream us right to your mobile phone. Also, you can find us on TuneIn.com. If you want to send us an email, we have an address for that. It's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Aunt Benet has that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Nighty night.
The 767 and the 707 were designed, the 767 and 707 was designed to replace the 704, 70, wow, is there a lot of sevens in
this? Yeah. Dude, I don't know that you can count on my file, Max, because I do live in Chicago and everything that comes out of this state is corrupt, so.
Pigeon. Okay, got it. Ready.
You ready?
Yep, go for it.
Steady. Red lights on.
Red lights on.
Solid.
Red
numbers increasing.
On. Yes, numbers increasing.
Excellent. 3, 2, 1.
Dubious.
Yeah, damn straight up dubious. Come on. Which came first, the naming of Hilo in Hawaii or Battlestar Galactica, which I happen to love, is really cool, but...
Hey, you had me going there when you said it's not for the yuppie areas, because if it wasn't in the yuppie, well-to-do areas, what were you doing there?
Oh, burn.
The Tiger Air brand incorporates fantastic value, punctuality, and a genuinely warm service with the customer at its heart.
Sorry, I couldn't help it. Sorry. Hang on, I'll play the laugh track.
You know, sometimes those guys cause me to conjure up bizarre images in my head. As I was listening to that, Rob, I just had this image of Simba the Wonder Dog sitting in the cockpit of a Saikar S1 with the canopy open and a scarf
flying
his neck, right? And
a scarf
and his tongue out the side of his mouth flying in the wind. I just couldn't get that out of my head.
Yeah, and since you guys don't know my dog, I am the companion of Simba. He's chosen me as his friend, and he's a Rhodesian Ridgeback, 110-pound Rhodesian Ridgeback who just became Steve Bisher's best buddy when he was up here to stay at our place a couple of years ago before Air Venture. So I've never quite gotten over the angst of that. But
also, I'm at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory.
Oh, God. Sorry. Were you recording that, David?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Got all choked up over my own website. And also,
okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And you can also find me at 30,000feet.com. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Nighty night.
Nighty night. They may be listening to this at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Good morning. Happy breakfast.
Okay, face it, folks. He's out to lunch all the time anyway. So what difference does it make?
Yeah. Ah, there we go. All right. We're out.